convicted not as a principal, but as an accessory, as all that could be proven against her was that she'd known of McDermott's murderous intentions in advance and had failed to inform against him, and that she similarly neglected to broadcast the news of his completed achievement. Even the Chief Justice recommended clemency, and with the aid of several strong petitions in her favor, I was able to save her life. By that time, the death sentence had been pronounced against both of them, and the trial had been closed, since it was thought unnecessary to go into the details of the second case. So, Grace was never tried for the murder of Nancy Montgomery.
And if she had been? Asked Simon.
I couldn't have got her off. Public opinion would have been too strong for me. She would have been hanged.
But in your opinion, she was innocent, says Simon.
On the contrary, says Mackenzie.
He sips at his sherry, wipes his lips daintily, smiles a smile of gentle reminiscence.
No, in my opinion, she was guilty of sin.
What is Dr. Jordan doing, and when will he come back? Though what he is doing, I think I have guessed, he is talking to people in Toronto, trying to find out if I am guilty. But he won't find it out that way. He doesn't understand yet that guilt comes to you not from the things you've done, but from the things that others have done to you. His first name is Simon. I wonder why his mother named him that, or it may have been his father. My own father never bothered with the naming of us. It was up to Mother and Aunt Pauline. There is Simon Peter, the Apostle, of course, who was made a fisher of men by our Lord, but there is also Simple Simon, met a pieman going to the fair, and said, "Let me taste your ware," and had no penny. McDermott was like that. He thought he could take things without paying for them. And so does Dr. Jordan. Not that I don't feel sorry for him. He was always thin, and it's my impression that he is getting even thinner. I believe he is prey to some gnawing sorrow. As for what I was named after, it might have been the hymn. My mother never said so, but then there were many things she never said.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see.
I hope I was named after it. I would like to be found. I would like to see, or to be seen. I wonder if, in the eye of God, it amounts to the same thing. As it says in the Bible, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face." If it is face to face, there must be two looking. Today was bath day. There's some talk of making us bathe naked in groups instead of by twos in our shifts. They say it will save time and be more economical, as less water need be used. But I think it an immodest idea, and if they attempt it, I shall complain to the authorities. Although perhaps I won't, as these things are sent to try us, and I should put up with it without complaint, as I do all the rest for the most part. The baths are unpleasant enough already. The stone of the floor all slippery with dirty old soap like a jelly. And there's always a matron watching, which may be just as well, as otherwise there would be splashing. In winter, you freeze to death. But now, in the heat of the summer, with all the sweat and grime, which is twice as much after working in the kitchens, I don't mind the cold water so much, as it is refreshing. After the baths have been got through, I spend time at the plain sewing. There behindhand at the prison with the men's uniforms, as more and more criminals keep being admitted, especially in the dog days of summer, when tempers are short and folks run to vindictiveness. And so they must use my extra pair of hands. They have their orders and their quotas to fill, just as in a factory. Annie Little was sitting next to me on the bench, and she leant close and whispered to me, "Grace, Grace, is he handsome, your young doctor? Will he get you out of prison? Are you in love with him? I suppose you are." "Don't be silly," I whispered to her, "talking such rubbish. I've never been in love with any man, and I don't plan to start now.
I am condemned for life, and there's no time for that sort of thing in here, and no space for it either when it comes to that. Annie is 35. She's older than I am. But besides being not always right in the head, she has never grown up. That happens in the penitentiary. Some of them stay the same age all the time inside themselves. The same age as when first put in. "Get off your high horse," she said, and dug me with her elbow. "You wouldn't mind a stiff piece in a tight corner. It never comes amiss. And you are so sly," she whispered. "You'd find a time and a place for it if you wanted. Bertha Flood did it with a keeper in the tool shed, only she got caught. And you'd never. You've got such a steady hand, you could murder your own granny in her bed and never turn a hair." And she gave a snorting laugh. I fear she has led a most disreputable life. "Silence there," said the matron on duty, "or I'll take down your names." They're becoming stricter again, as there is a new head matron, and if there are too many marks against you, they cut off your hair. After the noon meal, I was sent over to the governor's house. Dora was there again, as she has an arrangement with Dr. Jordan's landlady that she may come to us on the days of the great washing, and as usual, she was full of gossip. She said if she told half she knew, it would take someone down a peg or two. And there was many a whited sepulchre wearing black silk and carrying lace handkerchiefs and having sick headaches in the afternoons as if thoroughly respectable. And others could suit themselves, but she is not one to have the wool pulled over her eyes. She said that since Dr. Jordan went away, her mistress was spending hours in pacing the floor and looking out the window, or sitting as if sunk into a stupor, which was no wonder, as she must be fearing he'll run off on her as the other one did. And then who would pay for her whims and whams and for all the running and fetching she required? Clary, for the most part, ignores what Dora has to say. She's not interested in gossip about the better classes. She only smokes her pipe and says, But today, she said, why should she care what the likes of those get up to? You might as well watch hens and roosters scuffling in the barnyard. And God put such folks on this earth to dirty up the laundry as far as she could tell, because she couldn't for the life of her see any other use for them. And Dora said, well, they are doing a fine job of that, I must say. They dirty it up as fast as I can get it clean, and the both of them are in the dirtying of it together if the whole truth was to come out. At that, a chill ran over my whole body, and I did not ask her to explain herself. I don't want her saying anything bad about Dr. Jordan, as on the whole he has been very kind to me, and is also a considerable diversion in my life of monotony and toil. When Dr. Jordan comes back, I am to be hypnotized. It has all been decided. Jeremiah, or I should think of him as Dr. DuPont, because that is what I must remember to call him, is to do the hypnotizing, and the others will watch and listen. The governor's wife has explained it all and said I need not be afraid, as I will be among friends who mean well, and all I have to do is sit in a chair and go to sleep when Dr. DuPont tells me to. When I am asleep, they will ask me questions. In this way, they hope to bring back my memory. I told her I was not at all sure I wanted to have it back, although of course I would do as they wished, and she said she was glad to find me in a cooperative state of mind, and she had the greatest faith in me and was sure I would be found innocent. After the evening meal, Matron gave us some knitting to take into our cells and finish after hours, as they are behind on the stockings. In the summer, it is light until quite late, and no candle grease need be wasted on us. So, now I am knitting. I am a quick knitter. I can do it without looking, as long as it is only stockings and nothing fancy. And as I knit, I think, what would I put into my keepsake album if I had one? A bit of fringe from my mother's shawl. A raveling of red wool from the flowered mittens that Mary Whitney made for me. A scrap of silk from Nancy's good shawl. A bone button from Jeremiah. A daisy from the daisy chain made for me by Jamie Walsh. Nothing from McDermott, as I don't wish to remember him. But what should a keepsake album be? Should it be only the good things in your life, or should it be all of the things? Many put in pictures of scenes and events they have never witnessed, such as Dukes and Niagara Falls, which to my mind is a sort of cheating.
Would I do that? Or would I be truthful to my own life? A piece of coarse cotton from my penitentiary nightdress? A square of blood-stained petticoat? A strip of kerchief, white with blue flowers? Love in a mist. The next morning, just after sunrise, Simon sets out for Richmond Hill on a horse which he's hired at the livery stable behind his hotel. Like all horses accustomed to a succession of strange riders, the beast is obstinate, with a hard mouth, and tries twice to scrape him against fences. After that, it settles down and plods along at a dogged canter, varied by a brisk, jolting walk. Although dusty and rutted in places, the road is better than Simon has expected, and with several stops at wayside inns for rest and water, he reaches Richmond Hill shortly after noon. It's still not much of a town. There's a general store, a blacksmith's, a straggle of houses. The inn must be the same one Grace remembers. He goes into it, orders roast beef and beer, and inquires about the location of Mr. Kinnear's former house. The landlord isn't surprised. Simon is by no means the first to ask such a question. In fact, they were fairly swarmed back then, he says, at the time of the murders, and ever since there's been a steady trickle of sightseers. The town is tired of being known only for that one thing. Let the dead bury the dead, to his mind. But then people want to gawk at tragedy. It's indecent. You'd think they'd leave trouble alone, but no, they want to partake of it. Some go so far as to carry things away with them, pebbles from the driveway, flowers from the flower beds. The gentleman who owns the house now is not so bothered, as fewer people have been coming. Still, he doesn't want idle curiosity. Simon assures him that his own curiosity is far from idle. He's a doctor, and is making a study of Grace. It's a waste of time, says the landlord, because Grace was guilty. She was a good-looking woman, he adds, with a kind of pride at having known her. Butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. You'd never have guessed what she was plotting under that smooth face. Only 15 at the time, I believe, says Simon. But could have passed for 18. Ashamed to have got so wicked at her young age. He says Mr. Kinnear was a fine gentleman, though loose, and most people had liked Nancy Montgomery, even though she'd been living in sin. He'd known McDermott, too, a prime athlete, and would have done well in the end, except for Grace. It was her led him on, and it was her put a noose around his neck for him, too. He says the women always get off easy. Simon asks about Jamie Walsh, but Jamie Walsh is gone. To the city, say some. To the States, say others. After Kinnear's place was sold off, the Walshes had to shift. In fact, there aren't many left in the neighborhood who were here back then, as there's been a great deal of buying and selling and coming and going since, the grass being always greener on the other side of the fence. Simon rides north, and has little difficulty in identifying the Kinnear property. He hasn't meant to go right up to the house. He's only been intending to look at it from a distance. But the orchard, which was young in Grace's time, has now grown up, partially obscuring the view. He finds himself halfway up the drive, and before he knows it, he's hitched his horse to the fence beside the two kitchens and is standing at the front door. The house is smaller and somehow dingier than he has imagined it. The porch with its pillars is in need of a coat of paint, and the rose bushes have run wild and show only a few infested blooms. What can be gained from looking, Simon asks himself, apart, that is, from a vulgar frisson and the indulgence of morbid interest? It's like visiting the site of a battle. There is nothing to be seen except in the mind's eye. Such confrontations with the actual are always a disappointment. Nevertheless, he knocks at the front door, then knocks again. No one answers. He's turning to go away when the door is opened. A woman stands there, thin, sad-faced, not old, but aging, soberly dressed in a dark print dress and apron. Simon has the sensation that this is what Nancy Montgomery would have turned into if she'd lived. "You're here to see the house," she says.
It isn't a question. The master's not at home, but I have instructions to show you around.
Simon is taken aback. How did they know he was coming?
Perhaps they have a lot of visitors still, despite what the innkeeper told him.
Has the place become a grisly museum?
The housekeeper, for that's what she must be, stands aside to allow Simon to pass into the front hall. You'll want to know about the well, I suppose, she says. They always do.
The well? Asks Simon. He's heard nothing about a well. Perhaps his visit will be repaid, after all, with some fresh detail about the case never before mentioned. What about the well?
The woman gives him an odd glance. It's a covered well, sir, with a new pump. Surely you would want to know about the well when looking to buy a place.
But I'm not looking to buy it, says Simon, flustered. Is it for sale?
Why else would I be showing it to you? Of course it's for sale, and not for the first time, neither. Those that live here never feel entirely comfortable. Not that there's anything, no ghosts or such. Though you'd think there might be, and I never like to go down to the cellar. But it draws the idle gawkers.
She stares hard at him. If he's not a buyer, what is he doing here? Simon doesn't wish to be thought just another idle gawker.
I am a doctor, he says.
Ah, she says, nodding shrewdly at him as if this explains it.
So you want to see the house? We do get a lot of doctors who want to see it. More than the other sorts, even the lawyers. Well, now that you're here, you might just as well. In here is the parlor, where they kept the piano, I'm told, in Mr. Kinnear's time, that Miss Nancy Montgomery used to play at. She sang like a canary, so they say of her. Very musical she was.
She smiles at Simon. The first smile she's bestowed. Simon's tour is thorough. He is shown the dining room, the library, the winter kitchen, the summer kitchen, the stable, and the loft, where that scoundrel McDermott slept at night. The upstairs bedrooms. Lord only knows what went on up here. And Grace's little room. The furniture is all different, of course. Poorer. Shabbier. Simon tries to imagine what it must have looked like then.
End of side 10.
With a fine showmanship, the housekeeper saves the cellar till the last. She lights a candle and ascends first, cautioning him against slipping. The light is dim. The corners cobwebbed. There's a dank smell of earth and stored vegetables.
He was found right here, says the housekeeper with relish, and she was hid over by that wall, though why they bothered to hide her, I don't know. Crime will out, and out it did. It's a pity they didn't hang that Grace, and I'm not alone in saying so.
I am sure you aren't, says Simon. He's seen enough. He wants to be gone. At the front door, he gives her a coin. It seems the right thing. And she nods and pockets it.
You can see the graves, too, in the churchyard in town, she tells him. There's no names, but you can't miss them. They're the only ones with pickets round.
Simon thanks her. He feels he's sneaking away after some discreditable peep show. What sort of voyeur has he become? A thoroughgoing one, apparently, as he heads straight for the Presbyterian church, easy to find, since it's the only steeple in sight. Behind it is the graveyard, neat and green, the dead kept under firm control. No rambling weeds here, no tattered wreaths, no jumble and confusion, nothing like the Baroque efflorescences of Europe. No angels, no calvaries, no nonsense. Heaven for the Presbyterians must resemble a banking establishment with each soul tagged and docketed and placed in the appropriate pigeonhole. The graves he seeks are obvious. Each has a wooden picket fence around it, the only such fences in the graveyard, to keep the occupants penned in, no doubt, since the murdered have the reputation of walking. Even the Presbyterians, it appears, are not exempt from superstition. Thomas Kinnear's picket fence is painted white. Nancy Montgomery's, black. An indication, perhaps, of the town's judgment upon her. Murder victim or not, she was no better than she should be. They hadn't been buried in the same grave. No need to endorse the scandal. Oddly, Nancy's grave has been placed at Kinnear's feet,
and at right angles to him. The effect is a sort of bed rug. There's a large rose bush filling almost the whole of Nancy's enclosure. The old broadsheet ballad, then, was prophetic. But no vine in Thomas Kinnear's. Simon picks a rose from Nancy's grave with some half-formed notion of taking it back to Grace, but then thinks better of it. He spends the night at an unprepossessing inn halfway back to Toronto. The window panes are so grimy he can scarcely see out of them. The blankets smell of mildew. Directly below his room, a group of raucous drinkers carouses till well past midnight. These are the hazards of provincial travel. He places a chair against the door to prevent unwelcome intrusion. In the morning, he arises early and inspects the various insect bites he's acquired during the night. He douses his head in the scant basin of lukewarm water brought by the chambermaid, who doubles as the scullery maid downstairs. The water smells of onions. After breakfasting on a slice of antediluvian ham and an egg of uncertain age, he continues on his way. Few others are abroad. He passes a wagon, an axeman felling a dead tree in his field, a laborer pissing into the ditch. Wisps of mist float here and there above the fields, dissipating like dreams in the rising light. The air is hazy, the roadside weeds hung with dew. The horse snatches mouthfuls of them as it passes. Simon curbs it half-heartedly, then lets it amble. He feels idle, remote from all goals and effort. Before taking his afternoon train, he has one more errand. He wants to visit the grave of Mary Whitney. He wants to make sure she really exists. The Adelaide Street Methodist Church is the one Grace named. He's looked it up in his notes. In the graveyard, polished granite is replacing marble, and verses are becoming scarce. Ostentation lies in size and solidity, not in ornamentation. The Methodists like their monuments monumental, block-like, unmistakable, like the thick black lines drawn under finalized accounts in his father's ledger book, paid in full. He walks up and down the rows of graves, reading over the names, the Biggs and the Stuarts, the Flukes and the Chambers, the Cooks and the Randolphs and the Stallworthies. At last he finds it, over in a corner, a small gray stone which looks older than the 19 years that have passed. Mary Whitney. The name, nothing more. But Grace did say that the name was all she could afford. Conviction leaps in him like a flame. Her story is true, then. But it dies as quickly. What are such physical tokens worth? A magician produces a coin from a hat, and because it's a real coin and a real hat, the audience believe that the illusion, too, is real. But this stone is only that. A stone. For one thing, it has no dates on it, and the Mary Whitney buried beneath it may not have any connection with Grace Marks at all. She could be just a name on a stone, seen here by Grace and used by her in the spinning of her story. She could be an old woman, a wife, a small infant, anyone at all. Nothing has been proved. But nothing has been disproved, either. Returning to Kingston, Simon travels first class. The train is almost full, and to avoid the crowding it's worth the expense. As he's carried eastward and Toronto recedes behind him and Richmond Hill and its farms and meadows, he finds himself wondering what it would be like to live back there, in that lush and peaceful countryside, in, for instance, Thomas Kinnear's house, with Grace as his housekeeper. Not only his housekeeper, his locked and secret mistress. He'd keep her hidden, under a different name. A lazy, indulgent life it would be, with its own slow delights. He pictures her sitting in a chair in the parlor, sewing, the lamplight falling on the side of her face. But why only mistress? It comes to him that Grace Marks is the only woman he's ever met that he would wish to marry. It's a sudden notion, but once he's had it, he turns it over, considering it. He thinks with a certain mordant irony that she may also be the only one who would satisfy all of his mother's oft-hinted requirements, or almost all. Grace is not, for instance, rich. But she has beauty without frivolity, domesticity without dullness, and simplicity of manner and prudence and circumspection. She is also an excellent needlewoman, and could doubtless crochet rings around Miss Faith Cartwright. His mother would have no complaints on that score. Then there are his own requirements. There is passion in Grace somewhere, he's certain of it, although it would take some hunting for, and she'd be grateful to him, albeit reluctantly. Gratitude by itself does not enthrall him, but he likes the idea of reluctance. But then there's James McDermott. Has she been telling the truth in that respect? Did she really dislike and fear the man as much as she's claimed? He touched her, certainly. But how much? And with how much of her consent? Such episodes appear differently in retrospect than in the heat of the moment. Nobody knows that better than he. And why should it be any different for a woman? One prevaricates. One makes excuses for oneself. One gets out of it the best way one can. But what if, some evening in the lamplit parlor, she were to reveal more than he would care to know? But he does care to know. Madness, of course. A perverse fantasy to marry a suspected murderess. But what if he'd met her before the murders? He considers this, rejects it. Before the murders, Grace would have been entirely different from the woman he now knows. A young girl, scarcely formed, tepid, bland, and tasteless. A flat landscape. Murderess. Murderess, he whispers to himself. It has an allure, a scent almost, hothouse gardenias, lurid, but also furtive. He imagines himself breathing it as he draws Grace towards him, pressing his mouth against her. Murderous. He applies it to her throat like a brand. 13. Pandora's Box. My husband had contrived a very ingenious sort of spiritoscope. I had always refused to put my hands upon this board, which would move for people under the influence and spell out letter by letter messages and names. But, being alone, I placed my hands upon the board and asked, "Was it a spirit that lifted my hand?" And the board rolled forward and spelt out, "Yes." You will perhaps think, as I too have often thought, that the whole is an operation of my own mind, but my mind must be far cleverer than I, its owner, have any idea of, if it can spell letter by letter whole pages of connected and often abstruse matter, without my knowing one word about it, for it is not until Mr. Moody reads it over to me after the communication is suspended that I know what it is about. My sister, Mrs. Trail, is a very powerful medium for these communications, and gets them in foreign languages. Her spirits often abuse and call her very ugly names. Now, do not think me mad or possessed by evil spirits. I could wish you altogether possessed by such a glorious madness. Susanna Moody, Letter to Richard Bentley, 1858. A shadow flits before me, not thou, but like to thee. Ah, Christ, that it were possible for one short hour to see the souls we loved, that they might tell us what and where they be. Alfred Lord Tennyson, Maud, 1855. I felt a cleaving in my mind, as if my brain had split. I tried to match it, seam by seam, but could not make it fit. Emily Dickinson, circa 1860. They wait in the library of Mrs. Quinnell's house, each in a straight-backed chair, each turned not too obviously towards the door, which is slightly open. The curtains, which are of maroon plush with black trim and tassels, and remind Simon of Episcopalian funerals, have been drawn shut. A globe-shaded lamp has been lit. It stands in the center of the table, which is oblong and made of oak, and they sit around it, silent, expectant, decorous and wary, like a jury before the trial. Mrs. Quinnell, however, is relaxed, her hands folded placidly in her lap. She anticipates wonders, but will evidently not be surprised by them, whatever they may be. She has the air of a professional guide for whom the ravishments of, say, Niagara Falls, have become a commonplace, but who hopes to enjoy vicariously the raptures of visiting neophytes. The governor's wife wears an expression of yearning piety, tempered with resignation, whereas Reverend Verringer manages to look both benign and disapproving. There's a glinting around his eyes as if he's wearing spectacles, although he is not. Lydia, who is seated to Simon's left, is dressed in some cloudy, shiny material, a light mauve shot through with white, cut low enough to reveal her charming collarbone. She exudes a moist aroma of Lily of the Valley. She's nervously twisting her handkerchief, but when her eyes meet Simon's, she smiles. As for Simon, he senses that his face is set in a skeptical and not very pleasant sneer. But that's a false face, as underneath it he's eager as a schoolboy at a carnival. He believes in nothing. He expects trickery and longs to discover how it has worked, but at the same time, he wishes to be astonished. He knows this is a dangerous state of mind. He must preserve his objectivity. There's a knock at the door, which opens wider, and Dr. Jerome DuPont comes in, leading Grace by the hand. She isn't wearing a cap, and her coiled hair shines redly in the lamplight. She has on a white collar, which is something he's never seen her in, and she looks astonishingly young. She walks tentatively, as if blind, but her eyes are wide open, fixed upon DuPont with the timorousness, the tremulousness, the pale and silent appeal which Simon, he now realizes, has been hoping for in vain. "I see you are all assembled," says Dr. DuPont. "I am gratified by your interest, and I hope I may say by your trust. The lamp must be removed from the table, Mrs. Quinnell, may I impose upon you? And turned down, please." And the door closed. Mrs. Quinnell rises and silently moves the lamp to a small desk in the corner. Reverend Verringer shuts the door firmly. "Grace will sit here," says Dr. DuPont. He places her with her back to the curtains. "Are you quite comfortable?" "Good." "Do not be afraid. No one here wishes to hurt you. I have explained to her that all she has to do is listen to me and then go to sleep. Do you understand, Grace?" Grace nods. She's sitting rigidly, her lips pressed together, the pupils of her eyes huge in the weak light. Her hands grip the arms of the chair. Simon has seen attitudes like this in the wards of hospitals, those in pain, or awaiting an operation. An animal fear. "This is a fully scientific procedure," says Dr. DuPont. He is talking to the rest of them rather than to Grace. "Please banish all thoughts of mesmerism and other such fraudulent procedures. The Bradyan system is completely logical and sound and has been proven by European experts beyond a shadow of a doubt. It involves the deliberate relaxation and realignment of the nerves so that a neuro-hypnotic sleep is induced. The same thing may be observed in fish when stroked along the dorsal fin, and even in cats, although in higher organisms the results are, of course, more complex. I do ask you to avoid sudden movements and loud noises, as these can be shocking and perhaps even damaging to the subject. I request that you remain completely silent until Grace is asleep, after which you may converse in low voices." Grace stares at the closed door as if thinking of escape. She's so high-strung, Simon can almost feel her vibrating,
like a stretched rope. He's never seen her so terrified. What has DuPont said or done to her before bringing her here? It's almost as if he must have threatened her. But when he speaks to her, she looks up at him trustingly. Whatever else, it isn't DuPont she's afraid of. DuPont turns the lamp down lower. The air in the room seems to thicken with barely visible smoke. Grace's features are now in shadow, except for the vitreous gleam of her eyes. DuPont begins his procedure. First he suggests heaviness, drowsiness. Then he tells Grace that her limbs are floating, drifting, that she is sinking down, 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 as if through water. His voice has a soothing monotony. Grace's eyelids droop. She is breathing deeply and evenly. "Are you asleep, Grace?" DuPont asks her. "Yes," she says, in a voice that is slow and languid but clearly audible. "You can hear me." "Yes." "You can hear only me?" "Good. When you wake, you will remember nothing of what is done here. Now, go deeper." He pauses. "Please, lift your right arm." Slowly, the arm rises as if pulled by a string until it is held out straight. "Your arm," says DuPont, "is an iron bar. No one can bend it." He looks around at them. "Would anyone care to try?" Simon is tempted, but decides not to risk it. At this point, he wants neither to be convinced nor to be disillusioned. "No," says DuPont. "Then allow me." He places his two hands on Grace's outstretched arm, leans forward. "I am using all my force," he says. The arm does not bend. "Good. You may lower your arm." "Her eyes are open," says Lydia, alarmed, and sure enough, there are two half-moons of white showing between the lids. "It is normal," says DuPont, "but of no import. In this condition, the subject appears able to discern certain objects even with the eyes closed. It is a peculiarity of the nervous organization which must involve some sensory organ not yet measurable by human agency. But let us proceed." He bends over Grace as if listening to her heart. Then he takes from some hidden pocket a square of fabric, an ordinary woman's veil, light gray, and drops it gently over her head where it billows and settles. Now there's only a head, with the merest contour of a face behind it. The suggestion of a shroud is unmistakable. "It's too theatrical, too tawdry," thinks Simon. "It reeks of the small-town lecture halls of 15 years ago, with their audiences of credulous store clerks and laconic farmers, and their drab wives and the smooth-talking charlatans who used to dole out transcendental nonsense and quack medical advice to them as an excuse for picking their pockets." He's striving for derision. Nevertheless, the back of his neck creeps. "She looks so odd," whispers Lydia. "What hope of answer or redress? Behind the veil, behind the veil," says Reverend Verringer in his quoting voice. Simon can't tell whether or not he intends to be jocular. "Pardon?" says the governor's wife. "Oh, yes, dear Mr. Tennyson." "It helps the concentration," says Dr. DuPont in a low voice. "The inner sight is keener when hidden from outward view. Now, Dr. Jordan, we may safely travel into the past. What is it you would wish me to ask her?" Simon wonders where to begin. "Ask her about the Kinnear residence," he says. "What part of it?" says DuPont. "One must be specific." "The veranda,"
says Simon, who believes in starting gently.
Grace, says DuPont, you are on the veranda at Mr. Kinnear's. What do you see there?
I see flowers, says Grace. Her voice is heavy and somehow damp.
It's the sunset.
I am so happy. I want to stay here.
Ask her, says Simon, to get up now and walk into the house. Tell her to go towards the trap door in the front hall, the one leading to the cellar.
Grace, says DuPont, you must...
Suddenly there's a loud single knock, almost like a small explosion. It has come from the table. Or was it the door? Lydia gives a little shriek and clutches at Simon's hand. It would be churlish of him to pull away, so he does not, especially as she's shivering like a leaf.
Hush, says Mrs. Quinnell in a piercing whisper. We have a visitor.
William, cries the governor's wife softly. I know it's my darling, my little one.
I beg you, says DuPont with irritation. This is not a séance. Under the veil, Grace stirs uneasily. The governor's wife sniffles into her handkerchief. Simon glances over at Reverend Verringer. In the dimness, it's hard to be sure of his expression. It seems to be a pained smile, like a baby with gas.
I'm frightened, says Lydia. Turn up the light.
Not yet, Simon whispers. He pats her hand. There are three more sharp raps, as if someone is knocking at the door, imperiously demanding entry.
This is unconscionable, says DuPont. Please request them to go away.
I will try, says Mrs. Quinnell, but this is a Thursday. They're used to coming on Thursdays. She bows her head and clasps her hands. After a moment, there's a series of little staccato pops, like a handful of pebbles rattling down a drain spout.
There, she says. I think that's done it.
There must be a confederate, thinks Simon. Some accomplice or apparatus outside the door under the table. This is, after all, Mrs. Quinnell's house. Who knows how she may have rigged it up? But there's nothing under the table except their feet. How has it all worked? Just by sitting here, he is rendered absurd, an ignorant pawn, a dupe. But he can't leave now.
Thank you, says DuPont. Doctor, please pardon the interruption. Let us proceed.
Simon is increasingly conscious of Lydia's hand in his. It's a small hand, and very warm. In fact, the entire room is too close for comfort. He would like to detach himself, but Lydia is clutching him with a grip of iron. He hopes no one can see. His arm tingles. He crosses his legs. He has a sudden vision of Rachel Humphrey's legs, naked except for her stockings, and of his hands on them, holding her down while she struggles, deliberately struggles, watching him through the lashes of her almost closed eyes to see the effect she's having on him. Writhes like an artful eel, begs like a captive, slippery, a skin of sweat on her, hers or his, her dank hair across her face, across his mouth every night. Imprisoned. Her skin, where he's licked her, shines like satin. It can't go on.
Ask her, he says, whether she ever had relations with James McDermott.
He hasn't been intending to pose this question. Certainly not at first. And never so directly. But isn't it, he sees it now, the one thing he most wants to know?
DuPont repeats the question to Grace in a level voice.
There is a pause. Then Grace laughs. Or someone laughs. It doesn't sound like Grace.
Relations, doctor. What do you mean?
The voice is thin, wavering, watery, but fully present, fully alert.
Really, doctor, you are such a hypocrite. You want to know if I kissed him, if I slept with him. If I was his paramour, is that it?
Yes, says Simon. He's shaken, but must try not to show it.
He was expecting a series of monosyllables, mere yeses and noes dragged out of her lethargy and stupor, a series of compelled and somnolent responses to his own firm demands. Not such crude mockery. This voice cannot be Grace's. Yet in that case, whose voice is it? Whether I did what you'd like to do with that little slut who's got hold of your hand. There is a dry chuckle. Lydia gasps and withdraws her hand as if burned. Grace laughs again. You'd like to know that, so I'll tell you. Yes, I would meet him outside in the yard, in my nightdress, in the moonlight. I'd press up against him. I'd let him kiss me and touch me as well, all over, Doctor, the same place as you'd like to touch me, because I can always tell. I know what you're thinking when you sit in that stuffy little sewing room with me. But that was all, Doctor, that was all I'd let him do. I had him on a string, and Mr. Kinnear as well. I had the two of them dancing to my tune. Ask her why, says Simon. He can't understand what's happening. But this may be his last chance to understand. He must keep his head and pursue a straight line of inquiry. His voice to his own ears is a hoarse croak. I would breathe like this, says Grace. Oh, she utters a high, erotic moan. I would twist and twine. After that, he'd say he'd do anything. She titters. But why? Oh, Doctor, you are always asking why. Poking your nose in, and not only your nose. You are such a curious man. Curiosity killed the cat, you know, Doctor. You should watch out for that little mouse beside you. She and her little furry mousehole, too. To Simon's astonishment, Reverend Verringer giggles. Or perhaps he is coughing. This is an outrage, says the governor's wife. I won't sit here and listen to such filth. Lydia, come with me. She half rises. Her skirts rustle. Please, says DuPont, bear with me. Modesty must take second place to the interests of science. For Simon, this whole occasion is reeling out of control. He must seize the initiative, or at least try to seize it. He must keep Grace from reading his mind. He's been told of the clairvoyant powers of those under hypnosis, but he'd never believed in them before. Ask her, he says sternly, if she was in the cellar of Mr. Kinnear's house on Saturday, July 23rd, 1843. The cellar, says DuPont. You must picture the cellar, Grace. Go back in time. Descend in space. Yes, says Grace in her new, thin voice. Along the hallway, lift the trap door, go down the cellar stairs. The barrels, the whiskey, the vegetables in the boxes full of sand, there on the floor. Yes, I was in the cellar. Ask her if she saw Nancy there. Oh, yes, I saw her. A pause. As I can see you, Doctor, from behind the veil, and I can hear you, too. DuPont looks surprised. Irregular, he mutters. But not unknown. Was she alive? Asks Simon. Was she still alive when you saw her? The voice snickers. She was partly alive, or partly dead. She needed, a high twittering, to be put out of her misery. There's a sharp intake of breath from Reverend Verringer. Simon can feel his own heart pounding. Did you help to strangle her? He says. It was my kerchief that strangled her. A fresh chirping, a giggling. Such a pretty pattern it had on it. Infamous, murmurs Verringer. He must be thinking of all the prayers he's expended on her, and all the ink and paper, too, the letters, the petitions, the faith. It was a shame to lose that kerchief. I'd had it such a long time. It was my mother's. I should have taken it off Nancy's neck, but James wouldn't let me have it, nor her gold earrings, neither. There was blood on it, but that would have washed out. You killed her, breathes Lydia. I always thought so. She sounds, if anything, admiring.
The kerchief killed her. Hans held it, says the voice. She had to die. The wages of sin is death, and this time the gentleman died as well for once, share and share alike.
Oh, Grace, moans the governor's wife. I thought better of you. All these years you have deceived us.
The voice is gleeful.
Stop talking rubbish, she says. You've deceived yourselves. I am not Grace. Grace knew nothing about it.
No one in the room says anything. The voice is humming now, a high, tiny music like a bee.
Rock of ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. Let the water and the blood...
You are not Grace, says Simon. Despite the warmth of the room, he feels cold all over. If you are not Grace, who are you?
Cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee.
You must answer, says DuPont. I command it. There is another series of raps, heavy, rhythmical, like someone dancing on the table in clogs. Then a whisper.
You can't command, you must guess.
I know you are a spirit, says Mrs. Quinnell. They can speak through others in the trance. They make use of our material organs. This one is speaking through Grace, but sometimes they lie, you know.
I am not lying, says the voice. I am beyond lying. I no longer need to lie.
You can't always believe them, says Mrs. Quinnell, as if talking about a child or a servant. It may be James McDermott come here to sully Grace's reputation, to accuse her. It was his last act in life, and those who die with vengeance in their hearts are often trapped on the earthly plane.
Please, Mrs. Quinnell, says Dr. DuPont, it is no spirit. What we are witnessing here must be a natural phenomenon.
He's sounding a little desperate.
Not James, says the voice. You old fraud.
Nancy, then, says Mrs. Quinnell, who doesn't seem at all affected by the insult. They are often rude, she says. They call us names. Some are angry, those earthbound spirits who cannot tolerate being dead.
Not Nancy, you stupid fool. Nancy can't say anything. She can't say a word, not with her neck like that.
Such a pretty neck once. But Nancy isn't angry anymore. She doesn't mind. Nancy is my friend. She understands now. She wants to share things.
Come, doctor, says the voice, cajoling now.
You like riddles. You know the answer. I told you it was my kerchief, the one I left to Grace when I...
She begins to sing again.
Oh, no, it was the truth in her eye ever dawning that made me love Mary.
Not Mary, says Simon. Not Mary Whitney. There is a sharp clap which appears to come from the ceiling.
I told James to do it. I urged him to. I was there all along.
There, says DuPont.
Here, with Grace, where I am now. It was so cold lying on the floor, and I was all alone. I needed to keep warm. But Grace doesn't know. She's never known.
The voice is no longer teasing.
They almost hanged her, but that would have been wrong. She knew nothing. I only borrowed her clothing for a time.
Her clothing? Says Simon.
Her earthly shell. Her fleshly garment. She forgot to open the window, and so I couldn't get out, but I wouldn't want to hurt her. You mustn't tell her.
The little voice is pleading now. Why not? Asks Simon.
You know why, Dr. Jordan. Do you want to see her back in the asylum? I liked it there at first. I could talk out loud there. I could laugh. I could tell what happened, but no one listened to me.
There's a small, thin sobbing.
I was not heard.
Grace, says Simon, stop playing tricks.
I am not Grace, says the voice more tentatively.
Is that really you? Simon asks it. Are you telling the truth? Don't be afraid.
You see? Wails the voice. You're the same. You won't listen to me. You don't believe me. You want it your own way. You won't hear.
It trails off, and there is silence. She's gone, says Mrs. Quinnell. You can always tell when they go back to their own realm. You can feel it in the air. It's the electricity. For a long moment, nobody says anything. Then Dr. DuPont moves. Grace, he says, bending over her. Grace Marks. Can you hear me? He lays his hand on her shoulder. There's another long pause during which they can hear Grace breathing, unevenly now, as if in troubled sleep. Yes, she says at last. It's her usual voice. I am going to bring you up now, says DuPont. He lifts the veil gently from her head, lays it aside. Her face is stilled and smooth. You are floating up, up, up out of the depths. You will not recall what happened here. When I snap my fingers, you will awake. He goes to the lamp, turns it up, then comes back and places his hand close to Grace's head. His fingers snap. Grace stirs, opens her eyes, looks around wonderingly, smiles at them. It's a calm smile, no longer tense and fearful. The smile of a dutiful child. I must have been asleep, she says. Do you remember anything? Asks Dr. DuPont anxiously. Anything of what has just passed? No, says Grace. I was asleep. But I must have been dreaming. I dreamt about my mother. She was floating in the sea. She was at peace. Simon is relieved. DuPont, too, from the look of him. He takes her hand, assists her from the chair. You may feel a little dizzy, he tells her gently. It is frequently the case. Mrs. Quinnell, would you see that she is placed in a bedchamber where she may lie down? Mrs. Quinnell leaves the room with Grace, holding her by the arm, as if she's an invalid. But she walks lightly enough now, and seems almost happy. The men remain in the library. Simon is glad he's sitting down. He'd welcome nothing so much at the moment as a good stiff glass of brandy to steady his nerves. But in present company there's not much hope of that. He feels light-headed, and wonders if his earlier fever is returning. Gentlemen, DuPont begins, I am at a loss. I have never had an experience quite like this before. The results were most unexpected. As a rule, the subject remains under the control of the operator. He sounds quite shaken.
200 years ago, they would not have been at a loss, says Reverend Verringer. It would have been a clear case of possession. Mary Whitney would have been found to have been inhabiting the body of Grace Marks, and thus to be responsible for inciting the crime and for helping to strangle Nancy Montgomery. An exorcism would have been in order.
But this is the 19th century, says Simon. It may be a neurological condition. He would like to say, must be, but he doesn't wish to contradict Verringer too bluntly. Also, he is still quite unsettled and unsure of his intellectual ground. There have been cases of this kind, DuPont says. As early as 1816, there was Mary Reynolds of New York, whose bizarre alternations were described by Dr. S. L. Mitchell of New York. Are you familiar with the case, Dr. Jordan? No. Since then, Wakely of The Lancet has written extensively on the phenomenon. He calls it double consciousness, although he emphatically rejects the possibility of reaching the so-called secondary personality through neurohypnotism, as there is too much chance of the subjects being influenced by the practitioner. He has always been a great foe of mesmerism and related means, being a
conservative in that respect.
Puysegur describes something of the sort, as I recall, says Simon. It may be a case of what is known as the doublement. The subject, when in a somnambulistic trance, displayed a complete